Welcome to episode 137 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously assaulted by other ne'er-do-wells as masterpieces. I am Nick, the noble cop first day on the job, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
Well, yeah, I'm sure I had reason for killing those guys.
Never really dwells on, is it? We are discussing another, we can't keep away from him, John Carpenter film.
And well, why we're going to run out eventually.
He may be our most watched director. I think he is. And rightfully so. He's very versatile.
This is his second film after Dark Star.
His first was Dark Star, wasn't it? Yes, which inspired Alien.
We will inevitably go back to someday, but...
Let's face it, we're going to do all of John Carpenter's films at some point, I suspect. But this is his second, 1976. It's as old as I am. So a very good vintage.
Done. Kids, get off my minefield.
So this is, I don't know, to my eye, kind of a zombie movie.
It was going to be a completely different film. I find that mildly amusing. After Dark Star, that had been a success. People were saying, okay, what are you going to do next? He had two ideas. One of them was this, the title we'll get back to. The other one was something called Eyes, which eventually became Eyes of Laura Mars, directed by somebody else.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I didn't seem particularly excited by it.
He gets co-screenplay credit, but I mean, basically it went out of his hands. I assume he was compensated for this. But they concentrated on this. Get it done first. It was we know each other, we know what we're doing, also our dads are wealthy.
Yes, it has the feel of a sort of a low budget. I mean, well produced, masterfully
well,
done.
Well, some of that is the setting. This was originally meant to be a Western.
True.
I mean, Rio Bravo is an obvious influence, but he was basically, he was definitely thinking Howard Hawks Western. And then, you know, $100,000 crashed into period Western and okay, this isn't going to work, but however, we can borrow an abandoned building for no money at all if we don't tell people we're using it.
There we go. That's pretty masterful. It has a feel similar to, the original Mad Max, I suppose, which had a similar thing, didn't it? That was going to be a different setting. And then for budgetary reasons, they thought, oh, no, let's just do it contemporary or near contemporary.
Yeah, filming locations based on where are the cops not patrolling this morning?
Well, this is a siege story. The story is... it's not a huge story. LA gangs are grumpy. They form a blood pact because one of their...
It's to get revenge on the police.
This is well before...
And the people of the city and generally. We're mad as hell, but not going to take it anymore.
Yes, this is like many years before Rodney King, but I guess not many years before...
Well, no, it's not even that. I mean, nobody's arguing that they weren't... this is the 70s after all, so you've got the revolutionary terrorist ideal.
Mm.
It's not clear to what extent the gang is actually trying to be revolutionary, but that's definitely a big part of their visual language.
Yes, there's some heavy overtones of like Che Guevara-style
gangsters. And indeed, the script hangs a lampshade on how they are strangely multi-ethnic compared with normal
yes.
gangs.
True.
A bunch of them, brackets, I think it was UCLA film students.
He got his extras
for this, get gun, ambushed and gunned down by the police. So the survivors are hacked off and decide to basically go on a rampage. It's quite a small rampage, but you know.
It's a limited zombie attack, basically, as they, from this point on, basically, they largely cease to have any kind of personality. So there's a scene, well, even there, they've not got much personality, where they form the blood pact, and there's very gratuitous, self-harming going on. And then from then on, they're really just zombies with guns, I suppose.
Well, the blonde, stupid one gets a bit of personality in that he is blonde and stupid, but otherwise, yeah.
Yeah, and so they patrol the streets. There's a kind of creepy... I mean, it's one of those films that's tension, 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 release!
very much as well, Halloween, to be fair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's funny how it is a similar template to Halloween, at least in the rhythm of it. If, you know, it didn't create the slasher film, and really, it is imitating kind of siege films and zombie films.
But I think Carpenter does the right thing here. Once you can only break the tension once in the film.
Yes.
So the longer you can hold it, to some extent at least, the better. I mean, let's face it, the fog as well. This is a trick he's using a lot at this point in his career.
I mean, it works. It's a tempo that does work. And he is good at building tension. I mean, I suppose I've said it before about Tarantino, but I think he is phenomenally good at building tension, then releasing it, and then building it again and releasing it. This isn't quite what's happening. As you say, it's a slow build and then a bang, 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 which works. It's a tempo that works. So the gang is patrolling the streets. We are introduced to, Ethan Bishop, who's the cop who is, I don't know, it's his first day on the job, I think.
I think it's his first day after promotion.
He's
done the highway patrol thing before, but he is now a lieutenant rather than a grunt.
All right, that makes sense, yeah. It's his first day in this position. He's assigned to a very soon to be abandoned police precinct, Precinct 13.
Let's talk about the title.
This is why you didn't like the title. That's a good point. Okay, tell me about the title.
Because it's described as Precinct 9, Division 13. I mean, I don't know American policeology particularly, so I don't know whether a precinct is smaller or larger than a division or anything else, but yeah, that's what it is. The name was given to it by the distributor, I think.
So what was Carpenter's name, or did he not come up with it?
Well, okay, I'm not saying this is necessarily better. He was originally going to call it the Anderson Alamo.
That's a worst. That's a worst.
And then he shopped it around as the Siege as well, but...
The Siege would work, I suppose. I quite like Assault on Precinct 13, but I agree. Assault on Precinct 9 would have worked, wouldn't it? Probably. 13's a bit creepier, I suppose.
Anyway...
We are introduced to him and are...
Played by Austin Bishop, Austin Stoker, who said, noticed at the time, you know, this is one of the very few heroic starring roles for a black actor in an action film if you're not going to do blaxploitation.
He's a stoic hero. He's kind of the straight man of the story.
And certainly in, you know, 70s California, the assumption would be, if you say a white person and a black person, a cop and a criminal, the assumption on film would be it's obviously going to be a white cop and a black criminal. And it isn't.
We do have a black criminal, to be fair, as well.
But, you know, as the primary pair.
Yes. And it's sad, whenever I'm talking about these actors, I have to look them up because none of them really went much further. I think Laurie Zimmer... who's Lee, one of the secretaries in the soon-to-be-abandoned police station, maybe did more than anyone else, but even then, not tremendous amount.
My touchstone is, when I look up the Wikipedia page, is the film I'm watching the thing they're best known for? And sadly, often the answer is yes.
I think that would be true of all our principals, really. We have Darwin Jostin as Napoleon. Which will always make me think of Dad's Army, I'm afraid.
He mostly did TV roles, I think, but a moderate success at the time, but he didn't get a big film career. We do see him again in the Carpenter film because he's the coroner in The Fog.
Oh, yes.
But
it's a shame because I think they're all really good here, all the principals.
First film role for Laurie Zimmer. I've forgotten her name already. Nancy Loomis, the other secretary, who spoiler-free, does not make it to the end of the film. I think this was her... I don't know if it was her first film role. It was certainly... She turned up at a casting call, and it was the first time she'd worked with Carpenter, and they went on to do quite a few other things together. So.
Now, isn't it Dr. Loomis in Halloween? Am I imagining that? I wonder what the connection is.
Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog. She also did some more Halloweens for other people, but yeah.
Well, most people who've worked with Carpenter, I've seem quite happy to work with him again and seem not to have had a horrendous time.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell. That might not be true of the Thing, actually, but in other ways.
Something I particularly love, and yeah, just a general warning, we are going to go deep into spoiler territory here, starting about 10 seconds from now. We've got that classic thing you do when you're introducing the child star, in this case, and Kim Richards as Kathy. let's just say she gets one scene and she's not going to get another one.
I found that, I was surprised to find that a heart. So, okay, the gang are patrolling the street, there's kind of tension building with an ice cream man.
There's also this prisoner transfer in the background, just, you know, these things are clearly going to intersect.
Yes, yes. And the gang pops up, the girl goes to buy her, I've forgotten the type of ice cream, which is probably not particularly relevant. I just get shot through the chest and killed. I found that quite hard, I'll be honest. I'm more squeamish. I don't want to, like, play the parent card, but I think a completely out of the blue child slaying.
I think that's some of the points. It's done better in other films, but I mean, we've seen Remembering RoboCop, where we've got the gang violence versus the corporate violence, and they have different flavours.
Yes.
And here we don't have the contrasting violence here, but this is, here I am, this is an entirely innocent scene, nobody knows anything bad is going on, and then suddenly bang, because I feel like it.
Yeah, it's all kicked off with the slaying of it, and I suppose it's the sort of thing, I don't think it was bad, I mean, I was then thinking, I couldn't get out of the headspace that the father was in then, and I suppose you could, so what happens is the father then panics and runs, and I found it difficult because there's very few circumstances even there where you would abandon your child even if they were dead, and so it took me out of it a bit. Now for the rest of the film he basically is broken, and that I understand.
Yes, insofar as he has any thought in his mind, it's Ruengi, as a great man once said.
Yes, it's the sort of thing that probably, if that happened in a role play, we're both role players, and if that happened in a role playing game, I would push across the red flag to indicate to the GM, do you know what? I'd rather we didn't game around this particular thing. It's just too difficult for me. So that took me out of the film a bit, actually. It's funny because if she had been among the slain and it had all kicked off before then, it probably would have been easier, but just to, I found that difficult. That's not just because I'm a father, I guess, but it is.
He chases down and kills some of the gang, and then the rest of them are going after him. So this is basically all set up to get the key things off. Here is the police station with minimal staff. It's basically the minimal legal administrative thing until the new station comes up in the morning.
Yes, and the phones are cut off. I mean, there's a number of tricks to isolate them from the rest of the world, even though they're in a city. And it's nicely done because the characters were like, wait, how is this happening? We're in the middle of a city. But it is well done. It's well
explained. I understand Anderson is, or at least was at the time, regarded as a fairly bad area of Los Angeles anyway. So he's working into actual contemporary, the classic urban wasteland fears as well as everything else. So we've got the station. It's already, you know, okay, probably nothing's going to happen, but clearly we're all feeling a little bit edgy about this.
Yeah.
And then they have the intersection of the prisoner transfer, because one of the prisoners is very ill, and, yeah, we got to go somewhere to call for a medic, and I've got this old map and there's a police station here.
I mean, the good news is his illness doesn't trouble him for all that long.
What is the guy's name?
What, Napoleon?
No, the father.
Oh, the father. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if he's ever named on screen, so you'd be forgiven for... Is it Mr. Lawson?
Probably. Anyway.
he's not really named, but he's the father.
Having worked out that shooting some of the gang is good, but it doesn't really work unless you shoot all of the gang... retreats, and the first thing he sees to retreat to is also the police station. He's barely coherent here. I don't think he even tells them what's going on, other than they're after me.
He kind of whispers something about it. Yeah, but they get the idea of bad things have happened, and it's this that then marks Precinct 9, They're never very specific with their demands. They don't really have demands.
Well, I think they basically want to kill him.
They're not trying to negotiate.
They're not at any point saying, "Give us something, and we'll come out, and we'll let you live."
Yeah, so demands don't really work because they're just going to come in and kill him. And that
really comes back to, as you suggest, that it's a zombie film. It wouldn't be the first zombie film, even if they were actually zombies. But it's definitely in that style. You know, there is no negotiation. There is no let's make a deal or whatever.
Well, this is post Night of the Living Dead, and I do feel that probably was at least something of an influence. I mean, these are relentless, non-negotiable murderers, really. They've just got to be fought because they can't be talked to.
But unlike the zombies, they're vaguely smart, so they can do things like climbing walls or shooting in through windows or
vague. But you're right; there's not really much of a plan to them, but vaguely smart, but mostly. Well, they're UCLA students. So,
As I see it, they're basically, they want to kill people, but it wouldn't be entirely surprising if they suddenly said, bored now, and went away.
Yeah, they're more of a force of nature than anything else. But right at this moment, they're going to come in and kill. And so they do. They assault the precinct. So we have, the prisoner group is assaulted, and we have two survivors, one of which is Napoleon, Wilson, as he's called for the whole time. Who's this? I mean, he's a great guy. He's very insouciant, and look, it's kind of cliched, he's this laid back prisoner character, but he's lovely. He's beautifully played, and the characterization here is all very good. It's all fairly shallow, frankly.
Yes, but it's well. Again, we are role players, and I think role playing games can benefit a lot from leaning into cliche.
Yes,
because it's a quick way of establishing, you know, this is this sort of person. You know this sort of person. He doesn't do any of that. Oh, I didn't do it, or oh, I was justified, or whatever. He pretty much says, yeah, okay, I killed those guys. You caught me. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he wouldn't escape if he got the chance, but...
Well, didn't he? Did I miss it? Isn't he down for statutory rape of a young...
I didn't catch that.
I think I heard that. Again, it's glossed over, but his crime is not a pleasant one. But he doesn't seem to feel the need to stand up for himself or argue. You never find out the truth of whatever crime it is, and it's not really relevant. The point is, he's in here. And all they've got to rely on is him and Bishop and Laurie, who are the three really... Oh, sorry, I forgot the second prisoner, who is... I'm looking at... Is it Tony Burton? Wells. Yeah, Tony Burton as well, who is the kind of, again, sort of stereotypical, I don't like this, I want to get out of here kind of...
I mean, one can't help feeling he does have a point.
Yes,
I'm just going to pull you up on the name Laurie, because the actor is Laurie, but the character is named Lee specifically after Lee Brackett.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes, all right, Lee. We're stumbling over the names.
That comes back in because she was one of the writers on Rio Bravo.
Oh, was she? Oh, okay, not the actor.
As well as the reason The Empire Strikes Back is the good film.
The one good, the increasingly good proportion of Star Wars film. Anyway, so the assault happens, and from here on in, it's really about the dino. The first assault happens, which kills, most of the people except our principal four characters and the comatose dad. And then it's the interaction between them all, really, and their ingenuity. And it's that kind of classic situation of get some characters that you like and do shitty things to them. And that works as a dramatic point of view. We've had shorthand views of all these characters. We kind of like all of them. There's a bit of sexual tension between Lee and Wilson. Lee likes the bad boys, I think. And then...
All right, it's a cheesy line, but I really do like the line when she is making him coffee and she says, black, and he says, for about 30 years now.
that made me laugh out loud. I don't know why. I like the way that she's unimpressed by this line, which I quite liked. But yeah, it's good. There's not much more plot to speak of, really. There's an assault.
Yeah, well, I mean, as with Halloween, as with the fog, there is this tension, and then the tension breaks, and then there is action.
Yeah, and it's good. I mean, it's well, what we want from action scenes, as we've spelled out before, is what is the circumstance, what is at stake, and what's happening, really.
Mm. I'll just point out that lots of this is happening in darkness or near darkness, but you can still see what's going on.
Yes, we're looking at you, Edge of Tomorrow, and many other films. I don't want to hear grunty struggles and splashes and just wait until... We allowed it in Platoon, because part of the point of Platoon was this is war and no one knows what the fuck is going on. But in other films, I want to know what's happening. And here we do. We know the stakes. If they let these guys in, they will kill them. And we know what's happening. You know how many bullets they've got. We know where they're positioned. We've been given a kind of... We've got enough of an idea of the layout of the precinct to understand it. Mm. I mean, they don't do a great job of... boarding it up. They do a much better job in Night of the Living Dead, I must say. But I guess they aren't quite expecting the assault. Like, they've got a bay window to defend. That's a tricky thing to do.
I think they used the producer studio's set for the police station interior upstairs.
Yes.
But the exterior and the jail cells were filmed in an actual disused police station.
It's good. Well, it gives you a real sense of place and claustrophobia and the...
If I'd been watching TV about the time this came out, I would have seen that police station set before. It occurs to me.
Yeah, probably,
It was available for anybody who wanted to rent it.
Oh, you would have thought so, wouldn't you? It's a nice set. It's very distinctive, though, but I guess it doesn't take much set dressing to make things look quite different, at least.
Yeah, there would be that extra level of familiarity. You know, this is this sort of thing. I know the sort of story that happens here. Which is interesting.
You know what, this feels... Talking of role-playing, it feels very much like a role-playing game scenario, like a one-shot convention game that you would play. And it just works, really. It's a nice dramatic scene. You like all the characters. Very quickly, Wilson and Lieutenant Bishop, you know, clearly come to a mutual respect. Bishop is flirting with Lee. There's not really a lot of the, you know, in zombie movies.
Well, Wilson is flirting with Lee as well, so.
Well, yes.
One of these relationships perhaps has a future; the other one certainly doesn't. But
that's fair. But it's not a lot of zombie movies are about, you know, bickering and we're actually more of a problem than the zombies are. But this one is, you know, we're pulling together as a team.
Yeah.
With the exception of Wells.
The plan is that he's going to get away and call for help. And I don't think he's not going to call for help, at least once he's safely away and, you know, where the police can find him.
He's going to go to the border at that point and they'll never see him again. But, yeah, you get the impression, yes, he's
spoilers
not going to do
doesn't
a...
happen, but...
Well, he's not going to do a Bishop... Oh, my God, he's... Sorry about my... Misrepresenting my Aliens references. He's not going to do a Burke on them, is what I'm trying to say. I mean, that's it, really. I mean, there's a fight. Everyone holds up well.
But they gradually barricade themselves further and further back in the station.
I mean, they run out of room. And it wouldn't really work in modern day because everyone would be there with their smartphones and the police would have got there much sooner. But it's nicely explained why the police don't immediately go down. Well, nothing's happening down there. It's the old precinct that's closed down.
Got to say, it would be fixable enough if you have a sufficiently... careful scriptwriter, you just let cause a bunch of cell towers to fail, and then the phone company will send out a repair crew eventually, and then you murder them as happens in the film, and then, then eventually somebody notices. But yeah, this could certainly get you through a night without major stretching.
Well, it only has to be a few hours, doesn't it, really? Because down in the basement, then they set off a bomb. Well, not quite, but their last stand, they have their very last...
Chekhov's explosives.
Chekhov's explosives. There's the assault, and then it's done, really. And it's a nice finish as well that we have.
And then the heroic LAPD turn up and kill everybody. The bad guys, obviously, the bad guys.
Yeah, only the bad guys. And these two men have come to a respect over their pretty shitty few hours, and so there's no suggestion that he's going to let that the lieutenant's going to let Napoleon go. There's no suggestion he's really going to try and escape. It's quite clear whatever he's done in the past, Wilson is a man of honour, and so is Lieutenant Bishop, and they kind of recognise that in each other.
Yeah, but at the same time, there is enough respect that Bishop is saying, I would be honoured if he would walk out with me, rather than be cuffed and dragged out by the cops.
Yeah. There's also no suggestion, at least that I remember, at any point that they're just going to throw the dad out. Clearly the one who's causing the problem. So there's a lot of... it is a very kind of... I mean, there's an element of... It isn't there, but an element of patriotism, kind of... there is an Alamo feel of, you know, we're not going to surrender. We're just going to fight to the last man.
Though some of it, I think, is surrender is never really on the table. I mean, the zombies, but they don't communicate with the gang anyway. But it's pretty clear from the messaging they're getting that what is happening is we are going to kill you all. We are not saying throw out this guy and we'll let you live or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's certainly not clear if they threw him out that would do anything for their own chances of survival. Yeah, true.
I would just like, before we wrap up, to delve in slightly into Roger's guns corner. Yeah, now we all know silencers don't work like that. Silencer is an aspirational statement. for the day.
In the films, they go, choo, and that's it. I know that's
this is a full power round off an M16, you know, 5.56 NATO, so it goes bang.
It's going to make a noise. If it doesn't make a noise, then it's probably not going to hurt anyone when it hits at the other end. Presumably, the only real way to silence it is to reduce the kinetic energy you're putting in, which is
most crucially, ammunition that is subsonic.
Yeah,
which is going to, as make you it... say, necessarily makes it much less damaging and shorter ranged for specialised roles. That can be useful, but that's not what's going on here anyway. So
I don't think they're doing specialised roles. It's funny that they have the foresight to silence their weapons, but I suppose
I think they were just in the crates they stole.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough. I mean, Carpenter is a true auteur in this one. You know, he wrote it or co-wrote it, didn't he? Or did he just write it?
He gets sole script credit on this, yeah. He's not a producer, but...
He does the soundtrack, which I will say is my favourite of all.
That cool theme is just lovely. Yeah.
It's lovely. I mean, it's like all Carpenter, it's kind of one theme and then he varies it around a bit, but it's often just a very repetitive...
Yeah, but it's a theme that works. I mean, it's a theme I have found myself humming out of context and wondering, what is that? Where did it come from?
Yes, exactly. If I think of... It's a theme that if I think of Assault of Precinct 13, I think of that theme. I mean, I watched it years and years ago. I haven't seen it since until watching it for this, but the theme has stayed with me. Mm. And even if I think of... I kind of associate it with zombie attacks as well. It gives me that kind of vibe of zombie film attack, even though it isn't really the soundtrack of many zombie films that I can think of, but it's that kind of theme. It's lovely. It's my favourite. I do like The Thing, which I did. Are there any that he didn't write? I'm pretty sure he did the one from Starman that I like. He definitely did Halloween. He definitely did The Thing. I think most of the ones we've watched, he did his own theme. Mm. But
well,
this is my favourite.
I mean, A, he seems to be actually quite good at it, and B, my goodness, it's a way to save a bit of budget. So.
Yes, exactly. They are a little samey, the Carpenter's themes, but then you could say exactly the same about all the other famous films. I mean, John Williams, to be fair, is pretty samey. I mean, they're all good, but...
My feeling tends to be that the job of a film soundtrack is to establish an atmosphere or to contribute to an atmosphere. It's not to be a piece of music that you listen to on its own. I mean, if it can do that as well, that's great, but it doesn't have to be.
Well, I guess films, I generally can't work.
What we have here is tension.
Yes, well, I generally can't work listening to music. Anything with words in it just distracts me enough. But if I have to work because there's some other noise that's distracting me, if I have to work to music, it will be film soundtracks generally.
Yeah.
And this sort of thing would be ideal for that. It might make me a bit tense while I was there. But...
They're coming for you.
Yeah, you've got to get on with it. Well, another John Carpenter film. Do we have more to say about Assault on Precinct 30? It's a short episode, but it's a short
film. I mean, I'm not going to claim this is a perfect film. It's not Aliens. No. But my goodness, I will unquestioningly say it's a masterpiece.
I think so. I don't know if it was... I think it probably was influential on another generation of filmmakers, but
this is another of those films that, you know, it came out at the, it came out in Los Angeles and mixed reviews, nobody terribly impressed. And then it opened at Cannes and in May of 77 and the British critics in particular raved.
This happens to Carpenter a lot, doesn't he? He gets crap opening reviews and then they become
That got it a bookie at the Edinburgh Film Festival in August of 77, and then London Film Festival in December of 77, and then enough critics saw it and raved about it that it actually got some traction. But it was basically a small budget failure until a year and a half after.
So this was, his first major success was Halloween, wasn't it? As I recall, but so this wasn't terrible.
Yeah, but. It was dawdling along and being unimpressive.
Yeah. He doesn't have a lot of luck with it. I really do think he is...
And then the British critics at that point loved it. And then it became a success in Europe and then became a success in the US as well to some extent.
There's a danger of this becoming the John Carpenter podcast, but I think we've both got a huge amount of respect for... He's so varied in what he does.
I mean, I think we've conceded that he does not always produce masterpieces.
I did not like Halloween at all, but I kind of respect what he was trying to do, but enough of his films I love. I mean, a little touchstone for me, spoilers, yes, this is a masterpiece, and for me it's a masterpiece because it sets out what it wants to do, and then it does it brilliantly, and then it's over. I mean, this one doesn't really have anything else to say, but we don't always want films to have something else to say. It is very good at what it does. But if a director has three films that I love, then they're fine by me. And, you know, here we've got The Thing, we've got Assault on Precinct 13, we've got Big Trouble in Little China. I love Starman. I'm not sure you would, but...
I don't think I've ever seen it.
We'll probably watch it at some point anyway. Ghost on Mars, I'm not arguing is a masterpiece, but it's much better than everyone says it is. In the Mouth of Madness, I don't think it's a masterpiece. You see, these are all very different.
But it has its moments of fun, even so.
Yeah, they're all very different films, but he's a good un. He's a good un. I wish you hadn't retired, John Carpenter. But I think he's given up on Hollywood completely. Yeah. Well, yeah, all right, fair enough. Okay, well done, John Carpenter. More of those, please. We liked it.
Yeah, keep making films of the 70s.
Well, we've survived the night and we can escape from the podcast into the open air. I'll be very happy if you escort me out, please, Roger.
It'll be an honour.